All right, guys, are you over 35 years old? Do you find that when you're looking at a wall, you see things in your vision? Guess what? You're not alone. And those things are more than likely floaters. Listen to episode 59, where I asked Dr. Jeff all the questions about floaters.
From the in-office studios of his eye care practices in Nashville, Tennessee, it's As I See It with Dr. Jeff Kegaris, your source for eye care education and receiving the type of patient relationship you deserve. It is time for a patient revolution. And now, your host, Dr. Jeff Kegaris.
Welcome to As I See It. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff Kegaris. I'm talking today with a previous guest where we really talked about more large-scale national, maybe even some international approaches to improvement in healthcare. It's Margie Godfrey again, who is the executive director and the founder of the Institute for Excellence in Health and Social Systems. She's currently at the College of Health and Human Services in the University of New Hampshire, way up in the Northeast, a great place to travel in the fall. Maybe a great place to travel at any time of the year, except maybe in the middle of winter. But Margie's a good friend and just somebody that I learned from continuously, even through these podcasts as we have discussions. We talked about bigger picture issues before, maybe the 30,000 foot level. But now I want to break it down into some of her new work, what she's interested in, what she's working on at the University of New Hampshire. So Margie, thanks for being with me again.
Thank you, Jeff.
So you moved from Dartmouth, and you've always done microsystem work. Let's start with that. Can you define microsystem for people?
Sure. Everybody knows what it is, but probably haven't called it. It's the intersection of where interprofessional healthcare providers and patients and families meet. And if you think about that space, it has technology, it has business aims. It's got operational plans, it's got a shared goal, and we can choose to make it the best that it can be, or it can be pretty dysfunctional because people aren't aligned, the systems aren't changing, there's leadership involved. So it's basically where most healthcare professionals do their craft every day with other professionals and patients and families at the center of all of this who are part of the microsystem.
And it doesn't matter if you're we're not talking about only a one doctor in a rural area with one nurse, a medical assistant, and an insurance biller. We're talking about microsystems that exist, multiple of them, in large organizations, medium-sized organizations, even small organizations, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You bring up a very good point, Jeff, that it actually can be an emergency medical team. It can be the small office practice. It can be an academic emergency department. So it's all sorts of sizes, and often in larger settings, like in primary care, if it's a large primary care practice, frequently groups will break down into pods. People might have heard of pods before. Mm-hmm. That is a smaller group of a few physicians, primary care docs, with some nurses and a secretary and nursing assistants to make it more manageable. But it, by definition, it's the smallest replicable unit or a building block of a larger healthcare system. So you want to keep it small in what you actually, those that you work with regularly.
So if we're thinking about the ED, for instance, it's not just the entire emergency department because we've got multiple shifts. It might be, can you break it down into that microsystem with that team during X period of time? I'm doing the 11-to-7 shift, and it's the technology, the patients, the people that are on this team taking care of patients at that time. Is that accurate or not?
It could be. I like to think about it more about the population served. So that's one of the challenges, particularly in a big medical center, is being sure you get the night shift involved, right? And if you look at silos that happen, there are often silos and them and us mentalities that happen between day and night. So having an opportunity to look at like the fast track in an ED would be one type of microsystem that, their work is to do rapid assessments and move people through for common ailments versus a trauma team. And the subspecialties within the ED would be the microsystem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's get into a little bit of your work from moving from microsystem at Dartmouth. You're still doing that, but now you've taken on a different role. Before, you were working primarily with medical students. Is that correct?
Primarily, yes. Geisel School of Medicine at mm-hmm. Dartmouth is medical students, and we would recruit and bring in microsystems, if you will, that consisted of doctors, nurses, secretaries, PT, OT, housekeeping, whatever, to help the medical students learn. We also had not only medical students, but professionals, mid-career professionals looking to get their MPH that mm-hmm. were in the classroom. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think some of our patients would say, wait a minute, I can't believe that my doctor learned anything about improvement or patient service or experience. I mean, they clearly didn't pay much attention because I didn't even know they taught that in medical school. Is that pretty common in all medical schools, or do you think that's still, unfortunately, somewhat unique at Dartmouth to be exposed to those type of thoughts?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of physicians didn't get out of medical school knowing how to run a business, Jeff.
Mm-hmm. a lot of us are still trying to learn.
I know. and I think probably in the early 2000s, increasingly medical schools became aware of this need to understand improvement. And there were professional organizations and regulatory bodies that started building improvement as an expectation in their education. I look at ACGME and other education entities that said it's not enough to just provide care. You've got to be able to improve care also. And at Dartmouth, under the leadership of Paul Batalden, he actually founded the Leadership Preventive Medicine Residency, which was a two-year program completed in conjunction with their clinical residency or fellowship. So that's a lot of education.
Phew, that is.
And it was specifically on how to improve care for patients and populations and to be a leader of it. Mm-hmm. So, and if you fast forward, it's really kind of cool if you go ahead 20 years and many of these graduates that took the Leadership Preventive Medicine Residency specifically to lead quality improvement with practicum experience and understanding, you know, improvement in outcomes are now in significant roles, mm-hmm. Like the, you know, looking at the state epidemiologists here in New Hampshire and leading other organizations. I can't name them all, but their knowledge has led them to higher levels of leadership in making a difference in healthcare.
You kind of wonder whether that drive was there all along, and that's what caused them to look more deeply and more well-rounded into the delivery of healthcare, or whether that stimulated them to think on a different level and helped promulgate their extra successes in their careers, you know? But extra education is really a benefit, especially
right,
in an area
right.
like this.
And then if you look at nursing, you know, there was the quality and safety initiative that came out of, again, the American Association College of Nursing had said that nurses needed, again, that had to be part of their required education. So it basically was a multi-pronged approach, I think, to get improvement into professional education from requiring it from the field and from an academic perspective and requirements and competencies, learning how to engage in improvement and mm-hmm. lead improvement.
So you were working with medical students, you were working with existing physicians and teams, microsystems, but now your slant's a little bit different at UNH, is that correct?
That is correct, and I think it's probably more representative of healthcare systems in that I have access to and the ability to work with undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral students. There's physical therapists within the College of Health and Human Services. There's adolescent and youth development. There's athletic training. If you think about health and social systems, there's also within the college recreation management and policy, which is very cool. Public health, if you're looking at OT, PT, nurse practitioners, nursing at all sorts of levels, which is really cool. Human development and family studies. I mean, so it's a huge collection of contributors to health and social systems that could actually, social workers is in there also, that can lead to better levels of health and life.
Off air, you said something very interesting, which was, you said, you know, interestingly, when these people all learn together, doesn't it make sense that they'll work together better when they're out in the world? And that makes such intuitive sense. And yet, that's not usually the way it is. I would think that UNH is unique in your approach to this.
Well, I'd like to hope so. I don't know that we're totally unique that way. But the new Institute for Excellence in Health and Social Systems is a bit of a reflection of my lived career. In that when I did my master's degree at Dartmouth in evaluative clinical sciences, we had doctors, nurses, policymakers, pharmacists, politicians in the classroom, which was very exciting. Mm-hmm. And in learning that way, you've got to learn new language with each other. You have to show respect for each other. You need to be curious and understand the contributions and able to work together. I mean, you can do practice projects and things like that within a classroom setting, but then you've got that lived experience that once you go out in your career, you can recall that and try to promote that. Mm-hmm. Dean Ferrara at the College for Health and Human Services saw the vision, we talk about creating the workforce of the future. How can we create a workforce who respects and counts on interprofessional collaboration and work together, has some insight into the contributions of the different interprofessional roles, and also at the same time is curious about research. Mm-hmm. So I like to call myself a practitioner researcher in that using an interactive research model that I was trained on in Sweden in my doctoral studies, that there are two spheres. One is the practice world and one is the research world. And how do we merge them? How do we create the space in between that either side or body of work or study can come up with an idea to research to understand more deeply and the other side helps? Building respect for researchers as a clinician and as a researcher, building respect for the clinicians and knowing that together we actually might be able to accomplish more in what our shared goals are when we learn to work together and acknowledge each other's contributions. So that's very exciting for the work that we're doing at UNH, to the point that we're looking at the first interprofessional fundamentals of improvement course that we're going to be running in the coming year, where all of those students as freshmen get to come together and learn about improvement in healthcare and begin to understand each other's contributions.
Are any of these virtual also, or are they only in-person classes that you have? Like if we had people around here that wanted to, this is a big healthcare mecca from in Nashville. If we had people that are listening and said, geez, I can't travel up to New Hampshire, but how do I tap into some of this, or should they occasionally go up to New Hampshire, or can we do some of this online?
That's a great idea, Jeff. I love it. For me, the best of both worlds is the hybrid model. Mm-hmm. And all of our developmental programs have been hybrid until COVID arrived. Mm. And then we were forced to become very clever and being 100% virtual. And it's worked pretty well, but I'm a promoter of hybrid because there's a lot we can do virtually. And then to me, the secret sauce is people getting together, that mm-hmm. we experience each other and learn together. And we can have more in-depth, comprehensive understanding of each other's mannerisms and styles and looks and things. And reactions than if we're not in person. So I don't have anything like that designed right now. We actually, I guess I should backtrack on that a little bit. We're looking at doing a four-course certificate course program that would have the basics of improvement, measurement, leadership, and variation. That would be primarily virtual, but I still would love to have some sort of gathering just to be with people.
Yeah,
so that's to come. That's on the to-do list.
So you just can't retire for a while. You got these things you got to create, right?
I couldn't find that word in the dictionary.
I don't think you ever would, and I don't think the people that learn from you would want you to find that word either.
As I See It, we'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Jeff Kegaris with Cool Springs and Donaldson Eye Care. We've proudly served the Middle Tennessee community for the last 26 years, and I want you to know we really appreciate you. Having an annual comprehensive eye health and vision exam is so important to the health of your eyes. From signs of diabetes, glaucoma, and cataracts, we're looking for it all. Don't let another day go by. Schedule your annual eye health and vision exam at Cool Springs or Donaldson Eye Care.
And now, back to As I See It.
How is it different in teaching improvement in a non-physician-centric environment? Do you find people need some of that professional background to understand it, or are they more open and interested in their involvement in improvement before they've even really had, you know, kind of that, well, I'm not a medically trained clinician, you know?
Yeah, I think for me, I have lots and lots of experience. I want to turn to my laboratory I've had the privilege to be in for almost 20 years in the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. If you look at caring for people with cystic fibrosis, it's one of the most natural, as some people will call it, multidisciplinary care models. Because you're dependent on all the different roles, whether it's a social worker, a respiratory therapist, a pulmonologist, a coordinator of care. It's a natural, makes it easy to do the right thing when everyone comes mm-hmm. together. And engaging with this group with improvement, there are ahas every time we meet with a group that they don't realize, and you've probably seen this when you do a process map. I didn't know you did that. Really? You did that? Or when I take this step, I then delay you in doing your contribution. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that goes on. So with that, it's just natural. As I begin to understand more of your contributions, our team dynamics improve. My respect for you improves. And the hierarchy is left at the door. We typically talk about no titles here. That we all have something to contribute. And most important contributor probably in the past, I don't know, 15 years or so has been patients and families of the population you're talking about. They actually hold the entire team to the true north. And many times some dysfunctional or disruptive behaviors of team members will not occur because you have a patient or family member sitting there participating and they would be taken aback. It's you can't say enough about this idea of everyone being together, including patients and families, to improve care and helping people learn about each other.
It's interesting. We have a weekly staff meeting for an hour every Tuesday morning, and at every single meeting, I had somebody this morning, and as a matter of fact, say, "Hey, by the way, where's our patient?" Because even if we don't have an actual patient there, we have a placard on a chair. Nobody sits there that says "Patient of the Week," and so that as we're making decisions or suggestions, we try to frequently say, "Oh, that's a great idea. Now, what do you think Mrs. Jones would say if she was sitting right here? Does that improve her experience or her care?" Because it's just important to have that voice in the room, even if it's virtual in our case.
Yep. So as you know, Sweden started What Would Esther Think? And this was 20 plus years ago that they decided there was a Matt Boisig was his name, a physician pulmonologist, who actually raised the question as the team was designing care to do the right thing for those patients. He said, "I wonder what Esther would think." And so they created the whole persona of Esther. Mm-hmm, Esther. Mm-hmm. And how would they, be sure that perspective was always there? I have found through COVID, our improvement teams across the country and around the world have continued, and the participation rate of patients and families have shot through the roof, more than doubled. There's always somebody there. And one of the things, one of the thoughts that some patients and families shared with us is they used to feel like it was an accommodation to allow them to participate. And they would always have to be by phone when we used that before Zoom, or, virtually. And they didn't see themselves as an equal because they couldn't physically be there, particularly for people with CF because of the infectious disease problems. When we went, when COVID came and everyone went virtual, they acknowledged they felt like an equal, that we're all here virtually learning and having conversation and making improvements. And they were more committed and more regularly attended, which was, I think, an unexpected outcome of everyone having to go virtual.
But a good outcome, one and unanticipated, right?
Yeah, very much so. We usually start most of our, if we're focused on a population, we try really hard, to have a member of that population and or family member in our improvement team. Not a guest, not a cameo, but they're a member. And we usually start our improvement meetings with a story. So the people that we're serving or their family members will provide a 10-minute story about, it can be about their diagnosis and or how things improved, or and it's very grounding for us when we do that.
Mm-hmm. So if you're in an office like ours where we're taking care of certain chronic eye care issues, glaucoma, macular degeneration, dry eye or ocular surface disease, diabetic retinopathy, et cetera, would you break that down into a bi-diagnosis type of story and interaction with the patient, or would you do it overall? Tell me how you would start, and I use this just not only for us, but also for other eye care and outpatient practices that are listening to the podcast.
Yeah. I really do that. As my family members have gotten older and I watch them with those diagnoses, number one, they don't want to be the diagnosis.
Right.
They want to be Peggy. Whatever their name is, that's who they are. And they have these conditions that they need help with, so they can be Peggy. And I think about, so what are the, I always like to think about standardized processes that we can customize. So how can we customize some of the standard evidence-based practice to Peggy based on her local context, where she lives and what she does? And I think, one of the biggest things, and I have great respect and admire you and your colleagues, Jeff, is that I watched, an 86-year-old woman who had progressive macular degenerative disease lose the majority of her sight. And this woman loved to read romance novels. She loved it. She loved to read the local paper. And despite trying to help her move over to audiobooks and other things, it didn't happen. And she just lost her social life. And I think being clever and thinking about that and how to help with that, because there's bigger issues, I think, also from psychological perspective that you all are dealing with and trying to help people manage those conditions that affect them personally.
Yeah, it's interesting because I try to get that across to younger practitioners, because it's, sometimes people just live in the moment, and yet the assertive clinician that is looking, they may never get the accolades for preserving someone's vision for an extra 5 to 7 to 10 years, but that's what they should, they may not see that outcome, but they need to know that it exists. When you can say, if I could prevent or push back your macular degeneration to age 98 rather than at age 87, I'm going to make a world of difference for you as a person, not just in saving your eyesight, but you know, saving your independence, your love, your enjoyment of life, your, you know, all those type of things. And sometimes you have to relate that even to people coming out or even people that are in practice that, you know, we don't try to hire anybody that's kind of got the just today view. There's got to be something more that we're here for, that we exist for, that we, you know, we may not get the pat on the back and that's okay, but that we know we're doing the right thing because of that. So a very good point.
Well, I think that's always been a very strong trait of yours, Jeff, in that you see beyond the eye. I mean, it's the big picture that you think about and plan about and worry about. I've always respected you for that. And it's also, I think, not only for those that you serve, but it's also those that you work with. You have a more holistic view of those that you work with and how to help them develop in their careers, and you take more of a personal interest that you should be proud of.
Well, it's nice of you to say, and you've influenced that as well as others have too. And I'm surrounded by a bunch of great people that motivate me a lot to keep aspiring to those type of things. You know, it's interesting we share that because I know in our lesson 12 in our book, when you talk about the personalization, people don't want to be a disease. We try to get across to everybody here, as well as in any practice, that, you know, our lesson 12 is a conjunctivitis did not just walk in the door, because we, even that breaking that tone when you, you know, you can be in an ED and say, oh yeah, I got a trauma this in room one, and I've got a broken finger in room two, and I got a this, you know, no, you've got a patient with these conditions, or I have Myrtle or Jane or Frank. Just that small little change, I think, can add an important level of personalization, even if it's just more of a, like you say, a North Star to say, yep, no, we don't have conjunctivitis in room two, and we don't have optic neuritis in room four. We have, 64-year-old white female that happens to have this, and her name is Myrtle. And we think this is what she is. She's not a disease. You know, she's a person first. So
we have to hold each other accountable to that. Mm-hmm. And there's times when we have low moments and figuring out how do we take the time out that we need so that we can be our best and honor everyone who comes in. And be curious about where they live, you know, what their situation is. That, I think the classic is people can't afford their medication. They'd rather feed their cat than get the medication they need for their health. And I just, the more we know, the better partners we can be for helping people live the best they can.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Margie, who do you work with now? You're teaching, you're growing this new generation of leaders in a number of areas. You also go out and are still working with other organizations. Is that correct? In addition to CF, the Cystic Fibrosis Group?
Yes.
Or are you so busy there in New Hampshire that you don't have time to leave?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we're searching for that opportunity to do health and social systems. We have some of our coaches that are working in local communities with like the firehouse. If you don't know, the firehouse is a treasure trove of information about the community. You know, in this firehouse is the ambulance services. So being curious, I think about Atul Gawande's Hot Plotters article. You know, where are the ambulances going? You know, what's happening in the community? What they know about the community members is huge. And so trying to actively find opportunities to partner with social systems and health systems. And in the meantime, we've done work with the National Hemophilia Group, the Cystic Fibrosis Group, the leadership of cystic fibrosis under the new leadership of Mike Boyle, and Bruce Marshall is looking at all of these inequities. How do we help anyone with cystic fibrosis get the services and resources they need? So they're going deep into communities and looking at, the ethnic issues that arise. I think about the work I did with the Vermont Oxford Network with the intensive care nurseries across the United States. And we realized a long time ago, like 20 years ago, that when we had parents come in, advisory groups, you know, come in about the neonatal care, it was primarily the affluent parents that were coming. Mm. So we weren't hearing the full picture. We weren't seeing or learning or understanding What did lower socioeconomic moms and dads, or single moms or single dads, or grandparents, how were they providing care, and what were the services and systems they needed? So I think that goes on, and that's really where we want to dig in. We continue to partner with the Sheffield Teaching Hospital Microsystem Coaching Academy in England. We've done a lot of work with them on, they have what's called a Flow Academy, which takes microsystems to mesosystems. And in that, they've looked at frail elderly moving from hospitals to communities. I do a lot of advising for them and learning. You know, I would be nuts to think I wasn't learning. It's a bi-directional learning opportunity that I seize all the time. We're working right now with McCall Institute on the West Coast. We actually are in conversations with a Middle Eastern country, to look at, and the Ministry of Health, and looking at primarily executing and sustaining strategies to increase improvement capability for everyone at the front line. We have some smaller hospitals, like, you know, as you know, we did work with Geisinger, and we did work with Cincinnati Children's Hospital. So there's some smaller community hospitals that are looking for some guidance and interest. And as I said, our development programs include the team coaching program on how to develop people to coach improvement. We have a group out of Vancouver that are working with rehab and recovery programs. It's very eclectic, which keeps it very interesting. And, you know, you can't possibly know the entire world. So, if you're comfortable with ambiguity and you're constantly curious to learn about populations and think about how ideas might be adapted, that's the work that we're doing.
Gotcha. That keeps you pretty busy during the day, at night when you're home, and before you go to work in the morning while you're in the shower, right? Just thinking about all those opportunities.
Well, still reading a lot, you know, and finding new people to be inspired by and to think differently. I mean, this year for me, last year with COVID-19, I realized, you know, as we get older and have a chance to reflect, last year, 2020 for me was about gratitude and thinking about all the various aspects of life that I was grateful for, people that I affiliate with, what are we grateful for? And this year for me, what's really important is perspective. And this goes directly into what you're talking about, Jeff, the perspective of someone who's in subsidized housing, or the perspective of someone who's homeless. You know, the perspective of, you know, politicians and, you know, everyone's perspective, being mindful and open and curious is what I'm really directing energies to, so I can have deeper understanding, deeper empathy, and be able to help in a more meaningful way for various groups.
Do you think that curious nature is something that people generally have, or is it sparked when they, let's say, go to some class like yours and start to think differently about their role in it and creating a positive outcome for people?
So I think there's many responses to that. I think reading, conversation, poetry, all sorts of media can stimulate us or provoke us to think a little bit differently. For me, reflection is huge, and dialogue is huge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being able to share thoughts and perspectives and hear other perspectives, even if you don't agree with it, you know, that's some of, if you want to get into politics, we won't do that, Jeff, but that's some of our problems is the, you know, the bipartisan, not listening to each other and learning from each other, that it, you might learn something that makes you think differently or you didn't realize. I mean, just as from a professor point of view, an improvement scientist, if you will, the idea of the ladder of inference, that's all about perspective. You know, when we're at the top of our ladder with data and information and perspectives and experience and beliefs that we drag around with us, how much of it's validated? Maybe we need to come down that ladder and look for more data, more information, ask more questions, to have a different perspective that, you know, honors the many perspectives in the world while moving forward in a respectful way. So it's, that's sort of what I'm thinking about.
It's there's a lot of respect needed at the base of all of those questions too, right? I mean, I got to have some respect for somebody to listen to their opinion and not immediately try to convince them of mine. So
No, and I think that, again, I mentioned it before, but I really think this whole body of humble inquiry that Edgar Schein brings to the field is so important. And I've seen coaches, I've seen all sorts of professionals and improvement teams soften because they've become more interested and they've sat still. That's you know, honestly, that's some of my problem, Jeff, is I was running too fast for many years, had lots of energy, and was trying to get a lot of things done. And I think as, you know, I've had more experience and I've gotten just a little bit older, reflecting and thinking, and saving space for perspective, makes a difference.
Hey, I have a quick question for you for some of our audience that are running businesses, running healthcare organizations, or even as a patient. As a simple step, are you talking about maybe having things that we would used to call, say, focus groups, coming in with a few staff members and patients and really digging into, you know, what they've experienced, or how, when you say, hey, start with 10 minutes of a story of you know, their life with this disorder or whatever that might be. Is that something that somebody, again, they could have a practice of five support staff and a doctor, small practice like that, very micro system. Could they do that? Would that be helpful? How do you get that patient voice into your flow, your systems, your processes?
I think there's many ways to do that. Focus groups is one way, but I like the more casual. It could be, you could create in your office, a partnership day or something like that. I'm making this up, Jeff.
Yeah, it's good.
It could be a partnership day. And everyone in the practice knows there's a communication that goes out and say, you know, you've got an appointment on partnership day, and we'd love to have you have coffee or tea with us, for 10 or 15 minutes if you're interested when you're here. If not, you'll just go through your appointment as usual. Mm-hmm. So making it kind of casual, but also knowing maybe from your survey what tends to be some hot buttons or concerns that people have that you could play off from to ask more focused questions to get more detail. So, you know, for me, there's many ways. There are the surveys. There are the focus groups. There's also interviews. That you could have with people, but make it in a genuinely caring way that we want to do a better job.
Right.
And we can't do it without you. So how can we partner? And if you prefer, you know, here's a website you can put things on. Or, you know, I would use multimedia to have all sorts of ways that, again, meet people where they're at. You know, some people might want to do an in-person discussion. Other people might want to do a Zoom or a phone call or fill out a survey or something. But pulling all of that together to sort of get a path forward. And, of course, with all of that, most importantly, I think, is giving back the feedback. You know, many times we'll be asked to participate in surveys or groups and we never hear what happened. So being able to say in a timely way, you know, within the month, we're going to give you a summary of what we learned, and we'd like to hear if we're on track or not. And maybe you're interested in helping, you know, that we want to do this together. So I think that's the way. And then constantly inviting people. Visuals, as you know, are so important, you know, having, whether it's a whiteboard or an electronic flat screen that's sharing, you know, did you know we were able to, you know, shorten the visit time, or that we answer, you know, phone calls within 5 minutes, or that, you know, we were able to do fundraising for Daisy to help her get whatever she needed. You know, I mean, that sort of stuff. There's a physical therapist that I use here And it's just amazing the stuff they put on their flat screens. That keeps us interested and curious. And like I've said sometimes, can you tell me about this? And the patient's stories in his newsletter is what also is their marketing. You know, there's things that they do as physical therapists I never knew until I started reading some of the patient stories in their newsletter, which to me, newsletter sounds ho-hum boring. And maybe it needs a new name rather than newsletter to get, you know, people interested in reading it. But the stories, as we know, stories matter.
Yes.
And the better storytellers we become, the more likely we'll engage and people will remember things.
They can relate to them. Say, yeah, that's me. Or I'm interested in that. Yeah, exactly. And maybe part of that is, like you're saying, less telling and more involving people together. You know, getting back to that, you know, we'd learn from each other. If people want more information about you and your organization up at UNH, how do they get a hold of you, Margie? Or how do they get a hold of your organization and find out about some of the classes you guys offer, some of your teachings, some of your work? What's the best place for them to go?
Well, Jeff, first of all, thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been a long time, and I think we get a lot done together a long time ago, and we can continue to do that moving forward. As much wiser improvers than when we started. I would say the best place to go is the Microsystem website, which is clinical microsystem, one word, singular, clinicalmicrosystem.org. And there's information there, and there's also a general mailbox to pop questions into. So we would be happy to hear from anyone and continue to build the community.
And I, as your eye doctor to the listening audience, would highly recommend checking out clinicalmicrosystem.org because there's a wealth of information. I think the better you're educated as a healthcare consumer, the more you can hold your doctors like me and like us and each of your doctors accountable to the level of care you deserve, no matter who you're accessing in a healthcare system. I want to really thank Margie Godfrey for sharing a little bit of her time today. I know it's later on the East Coast. And Margie, thank you very much. You continue to be somebody that stimulates my thirst for getting better all the time. And that's something that we will continue to, I hope that our patients see the benefit of more and more of our conversations. Thank you for sharing all that you're doing, and just know that whether you get a lot of letters or only a few, you are really motivating healthcare practitioners across the country and across the world, and I can certainly tell you here in Nashville, Tennessee, in a great way to provide better care. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And Jeff, as I said all along, we need everyone. So the more consumers, those that we serve, professionals, anyone in the community can come together, we'll get where we want to go once we have everyone involved. So thank you.
Thank you. So this is As I See It. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff Kegaris. Stay with us for next week's edition on another patient experience, clinical eye care, or just something fun that I want to talk about podcast. I appreciate your listenership. Please don't hesitate to send an email to cole@coolspringseyecare.com because I look at all of those comments as I'm drinking my chamomile tea in the morning. Thank you very much. See you next week. Bye-bye.